William Binney. William Binney on this 4th of July. William Binney is an ex-senior analyst for the NSA. He has served this country for 37 years before he left in 2001. I'm not even looking at notes right now because Benny's been on, Mr. Binney's been on our show many times, and he's the subject of a great documentary called A Good American by Fritz Moser and David Lugo, and Oliver Stone is the executive producer, and I recommend that you see that. But now the sequel is out, and I recommend that you see the sequel I have. And we're going to be playing excerpts of that, or probably playing a lot of it in the coming weeks, but not today. I just wanted to tell you, William Binney, what a great American you are.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's always... always a pleasure. I know that you took an oath when you joined the NSA, and you know all about the Constitution. You carry that around. When you look at the Declaration of Independence and you look at the Bill of Rights, how do you think the Founding Fathers would look at the way this country has evolved over the last, couple of decades?
Well, I don't think they'd look too kindly on it. I view this as basically us transitioning from a state of advocacy for freedom and people's rights under the Bill of Rights and the Constitution into moving to the dark side, which is what Cheney had declared that we were doing. So I refer to him now as Darth Cheney.
Darth Cheney.
Darth Cheney, because, he went to the dark side. He took a lot of us with us. And there's still a lot of us who are objecting to that, and I think that we've lost our way as Americans because we've simply lost the understanding of what it really means to be American. We need to stand up for the rights of individuals and people, and not just here but around the world. I mean, we've lost all perspective on what the Constitution really means. It's fundamental rights of humanity. That's what it stands for, and that's what we all used to really stand up and fight for. I mean, that's what my father did in World War II, and I was in the service, and everybody in the service, I think, has that as the understanding of what this country's all about.
Yes, absolutely. Bill Binney, 37 years you worked for the government, and then you left in 2001 after 9/11. I think it was October because of that controversy with Thin Thread is it Pathfinder or Trailblazer?
It was Trailblazer. Yeah,
but I finally got it right. All right. Yeah, yes. Right. Well, I'm not using notes today, okay? But
okay.
I got a pile of notes here, but it looks like I'm Harpo Marx. There's so many notes around it, there's no point me looking at one. When you got out and then you got into trouble, I want to talk about your experience because the next guest had a very bad experience with the Justice Department and the FBI. How were you treated in a nutshell there?
Actually, pretty poorly, and more like they were manufacturing evidence against me. It was a total fabrication of evidence that they were going to use to indict us and put us in jail for 35 years based on the Espionage Act. But that was the whole plan. But the only reason I'm not there is because I caught them at their lying and had direct evidence of them and what their lies were. So they really basically had to drop it and run away. Otherwise, I would have had them in a court of law, which is what I was threatening to do.
But what you got off, but it didn't, like, your life changed dramatically. I mean, you had to go through a lot of hell after that was over. You suffered the consequences of coming out and fighting against the government. What happened to you afterwards? How did they invade your life or affect your life after you were exonerated?
Well, they fundamentally made it impossible to get work. I mean, they shut us off by taking away the clearances, which was the right to practice our skill. And when they did that, it shut doors all over the place. And then, of course, they even kept going, trying to keep us off balance, using the Department of Justice, the supposed Department of Justice of the United States, which I now call just the Department of Just Us.
Yes.
In other words, there's only a few people in it. Not all of us are there, and not like we're supposed to be. But that's not the case anymore. So,
do you think that they're being used? That they are being used stymie dissent here?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's absolutely what they're doing. They're trying to shut everybody down. I call it the happiness management program. As long as everybody's happy, nobody gets attacked, and they keep everybody in line. It's a matter of population control. That's really what they're doing.
So that's the motivation. Well, how about the people like you? You were actually a senior, but the people mid-level, do they go along with this, or has this all been scattered to private contractors, and you wouldn't even know who's working for the NSA?
Well, basically the fundamental point is the thing that they've been doing is that anybody working for the government has been intimidated and threatened. Look at what they did with Jim Risen and Jim Rosen and the Associated Press, or the Tea Party, or the Occupy group, or anybody like, I maintain they did to Elliot Spitzer and the former Joe Nocio, the former CEO of Quest. I mean, when he refused to give them data, they went after him and put him in jail for 5 years as a setup. I mean, he even told me I talked to him before too, and he said they fabricated evidence against him. So, you know, this is. They'll go to any extent they have to shut people up and make them do what they want them to do. That's the problem. This is why I'm out there trying to get them back into court. I've got 4 separate lawsuits I'm supporting against them to get them into court to force the issue out in open court.
Wow, that's amazing. 4 separate lawsuits against the government. I guess they are not too happy with you. How is the press treating you? Are you getting much press besides radio, free radio or free speech radio, WBAI? Are you getting a lot of press out there?
There's a few radio stations and a few cable network stations that carry will invite me on and so on. Oh. I've been invited a couple times on Fox and once or twice on CNN and USA Today, but that's about it. The mainstream media is kind of steering away from this subject.
Well, you know, it's funny. Every time I turn on CNN, which I can barely do these days, or MSNBC, there's always an expert, a retired NSA, someone like Michael Hayden, who used to be the CIA clapper, all these guys with shaved heads that get on, and those are the guys that they go to. I'm looking for someone that has a different opinion, and they never have a different opinion. You know, why don't they ask you to come on and give them a different opinion so we can make our own decision based on the various voices?
Well, I think that's the point. The government is in league with the mainstream media to control the narrative, and if that's all the people of the country hear is that one narrative, that's fundamentally all they believe. This is pretty much like a controlled press.
Right. So let me ask you, is it going to get worse? I mean, what direction are we going right now with Vault 7 and the information released by WikiLeaks about CIA now using a lot of the programs that the NSA used? Is it going to get worse? I mean, or is it going to get better? What do we do for it to get better at this point?
Well, I mean, potentially with the Internet of Things, I mean, this really gets to be much worse, or the potential to get much worse, unless we do something about it to stop this mechanism acquiring information about everybody in the country so you can control them. I mean, if we don't do that, you know, we're going to be in really deep trouble, simply because they'll have all the knowledge of everything we are doing virtually every minute of the day, and that's going to be terrible to overcome.
Well, it's pretty cumbersome. What are they going to do with all of that metadata? I mean, are they going to go specifically for people that they want to get? They take everybody and then they, like, look for people that they'd like to, like, silence? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. I mean, when you have collection on everybody, you can selectively target anyone you want. Like in NSA's case, they've got targeting on the Congress, members of Congress, the White House, candidates, federal judges in the Supreme Court, all the way through federal courts, anybody, and also the Joint Chiefs of Staff, things like that. Anybody who has got power over them, they've got this data and look at, so they have them targeted.
It pretty much neutralizes any dissent, I suppose, amongst our elected officials and those in the military who would like to voice their dissent.
Well, it makes them afraid, just like Senator Schumer was telling or advising President Trump that he shouldn't cross the intelligence community simply because they've got many ways to get back at him. Well, these are the ways they do it.
6 days from Sunday, he said.
Yeah.
Right. So they definitely got Schumer. They definitely got information on Schumer. He's pretty much complied with everything that the military-industrial complex and the IC wants. Bill Binney, when does your movie, or has it opened, the sequel to your film?
I think The Maze, you mean it? Yes, I think it's I think it's out now. I'm not in the production line or the distribution line, so I'm not really up to speed on exactly when it's coming out. But Fritz Moser, of course, directed that one too. So it's really, again, getting along the same kinds of lines, but it's trying to educate people on what's really going on here in this country and around the world. And that people have to wake up to. We're going to be down a very bad and dark spot and hole in the ground.
Well,
because we're going down.
Yeah. Well, listen, I can't wait to have it here at WI, because I think it's fantastic, and I'm using one of Trump's superlatives. Fantastic. I think it's fantastic. It's wonderful. No, I want to have you back on in a couple of weeks and get Fritz back on and do like an hour with you. I just wanted to say today that happy 4th of July. I'm sorry for what you've gone through. And how the country treated you. You have been a very patriotic American, and I know that people like Sam Adams and Thomas Paine would be proud of the work and sacrifice that you've made for this country. Thank you. William Binney will be talking to you very soon.
All right, thank you.
Okay, William Binney will be back with Barrett Brown after a little more Satchmo here.
Sharp as pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them a burly wife, just a jackknife has Mac Heat, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's Mac Heat, dear? So there's not a trace of red on the sidewalk. Sunday morning even lies a body oozing life. Someone sneaking around the corner. Is this someone Mac the knife from a tugboat by the river?
All right. I used to close with that song in my act when I was in Las Vegas. All right. We are back here at WBAI. What a great guy, William Binney. So, wow, this guy here. This guy, Barrett Brown. What an interesting individual. I hate to read from like a piece of paper. He's a writer. He's an activist. What I like about him is that he is a kind of a prankster as well. He is a satirist. He is a great funny guy, as well as being a great writer. He's written for The Guardian. He's written for The Intercept, Skeptic, Vanity Fair. And he's got this new project out that we'll be talking about. He's the founder of Project PM. And like I said, I hate to read from a piece of paper, especially when I'm half blind. Barrett Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Barrett, I just want to begin here, going back, to your, the beginning of you becoming quite, infamous or famous and a hero to people like me. And this is from, something I picked up from Julian Assange, and I will read it. Barrett Brown's Hunter Thompson style, his public lampooning of the U.S. security state, and his defense of WikiLeaks and Anonymous did not win him friends in the U.S. administration. And soon enough, the FBI was looking for any excuse to take him down. So why don't you go back to when he first wrote this, or to what he was talking about? Back to the beginning.
So this was back in right before my sentencing.
It's okay, man. This is live radio. We expect that. Usually it's here in New York that we get ambulances on the street.
That's true. You guys have a word problem.
I'm waiting for one to go by now. Here.
Yeah, I used to live in Brooklyn, so I'm...
That's where we are. We're in Brooklyn.
Very well. Well, I wish I was there with you. So this is back to my sentencing. I'd already done 2.5 years in federal holding cells while waiting for sentencing on these various charges, many of which the U.S. government had to drop.
Were those charges there? What were those charges that you were waiting two years without bail? You were just there, preemptive bail, for 2 years. So go back to that part there. For people who don't know, most people who are listening do know.
So originally, the FBI started getting search warrants on me, starting a few weeks after a hack that I had been entangled with had revealed that the DOJ itself had set in motion a criminal conspiracy against journalists and activists, and had done so through several companies that we call intelligence contractors. One was H.B. Gary, one was Palantir, which is more well-known now because Peter Thiel co-founded it. And so this had led to about a month of media flurry and the resignation of one of the individuals involved and apologies from Palantir and a call for a congressional investigation on the floor of the House, which never actually ended up happening. So instead of investigating the people who had been revealed to have, for instance, plotted hacking attacks on WikiLeaks and who plotted the setting up of American activists with Code Pink and other organizations on fraud charges and going after Glenn Greenwald and, in their words, trying to intimidate him to stop him from supporting WikiLeaks, instead of investigating that, they investigated us.
Is this guy Barr? The guy Barr, is that his name?
Aaron Barr. Aaron Barr was an ex-military fellow who was the head of this company, H.B. Gary Federal.
Right.
Which had been in the business of what we call intelligence contracting, providing services and software and other sort of espionage solutions, both to the U.S. government and to companies close to the U.S. government. Banks, Bank of America in this case, and U.S. Chamber of Commerce were the two entities that they had created this original proposal for, going after these activists and going after WikiLeaks.
Why Bank of America? Why were they interested?
Bank of America was concerned because Julian Assange had at some point previously said that they had a thumb drive or some such deriving from a major American bank showing wrongdoing. And Bank of America, I guess they realized, well, we've been doing a lot of wrongdoing. That might be us.
All right.
And so they had gone to the DOJ and said, we want to go after WikiLeaks. And the DOJ, which is a concierge service for powerful interests, apparently, said, sure, we're going to put you in touch with this law firm, Hunton & Williams, and they'll take it from there. And Hunton & Williams oversaw this new relationship between Bank of America and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which itself wanted to go after activists with the group Stop the Chamber that had been pointing out its misdeeds. And so these companies that the Hunton & Williams sort of got working together, H.B. Gary, Palantir, Verico, and InGame Systems, called themselves Team Themis for the purpose of this project and started creating slides for their customers, Bank of America and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in which they described how they could engage in illicit activities against their enemies, including American citizens and including journalists. And so it just happened that Aaron Barr also got in a fight around this time with Anonymous. He'd come out and said to Financial Times that he had infiltrated the chat servers and had discovered our secret leadership, and he put out information that we knew to be incorrect to this reporter, talking about, oh, this guy is their leader, this guy is about to step down as a leader, he's looking for a place, maybe it was just nonsense. And it occurred to us that this information, which he was saying he was going to give to the FBI, and which he was, it turns out, indeed trying to give the FBI, would have gotten people raided and arrested who were not even involved in Anonymous. And in addition to that, probably some people who were. And so it's a small group of hackers that I was associated with. The next day after this article came out, they raided his servers and they deleted a lot of his files and they stole 70,000 emails from that company, to other companies and to the government. It's been a year and a half's worth of correspondence, and found the file, his notes on this Anonymous stuff, and then put that out and gave it a nice critique online showing here's why he's wrong. Again, this is something that was, you know, blah, 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 this is all nonsense. And, you know, it was a big thing. The media loved it. It was not just, you know, it was a dramatic incident. It was very cinematic. And then within a few days, we had started hitting upon, while looking through those emails, these other issues, these other programs that existed that H.P. Gary was involved in. H.P. Gary, as it happens, was very well connected with other much larger firms, SAIC, TISC, Palantir, of course, Archimedes Global. Aaron Barr himself had been a major star in the intelligence operations at Northrop Grumman for a long period of time. So, but he was depicted as kind of a silly person who would just, you know, kind of was in over his head, which is in some cases true, but he was also a capable fellow who was kind of at the forefront of a lot of very dangerous technologies. And those are the things that we started researching over the next few months.
I see. Wow. So that, now that's then. And then you, how did you get in trouble the first time? The first three charges here that were connected to Stratfor. And maybe you want to give us a little bit of background on Stratfor.
Yeah, well, the most important thing to know about Stratfor in relation to my case is that when the FBI executed a search warrant in March of 2012, 4 months after the Stratfor incident had happened, they did not list Stratfor on my search warrant. They listed H.P. Gary Federal. They listed Endgame Systems. They listed Project PM, my collaborative journalism group, and Echelon2.org, which was at that time the site where we compiled all this information. Later, they charged me with this incident involving Stratfor, in which I had copied and pasted a link that had been posted in one of the anonymous chat rooms by one of the hackers who had hacked Stratfor, similar to the H.P. Gary hack. And I copied and pasted that link, pasted it into my Project PM chat, which had about 20, 30 people in it, researchers, journalists, activists who were interested in these issues. And then I asked, what's in these links? And the guy said, oh, this is actually customer data, customer credit card data. I said, oh. And never opened the file myself, you know, as the government's own forensics showed. Certainly didn't encourage anybody to use the credit card numbers, which is something I've never done. You know, as the government knew full well, I was looking for emails. In fact, after my sentencing, an article came out showing that the FBI had withheld a report from the San Antonio branch of the FBI, in which they admit that they, too, thought these would be emails.
So you did not know that they were credit card numbers
right
there. Now, I want to stop you there because I want to play this little clip that Anonymous Scandinavia made for me today, and because this goes right to what happened then, and give you just a little break here and come back. This is only like a minute and 30 seconds long. We'll be right back. Can you wait, Barrett?
Absolutely.
Okay. So if we have it, do we have that set up?
The Pop Echo one?
No, no, the other one. The other one, yes. All right. We are at WBAI. I'm Randy Credico. Tony Ryan is in today. We're ready? Okay, we'll be right back with you, Barrett.
Their claim is that he took a link, copied it. It's journalistically important to get the client list. Pasted it into the Project PM chat room, and in that one move, produced criminal exposure for himself.
The Barrett Brown case is another one of these seminal cases, and the government wants to send a very chilling message. It's fundamentally a First Amendment case. How dare you hold up the mirror to us?
They called Project PM a criminal organization. And that's what people freaked out about, because there were a whole bunch of people who hung out on that server or that wiki, and like, wait, this is a criminal.
I think they're after who? Anyone else? Any other names to put on our list of people to watch?
The tingly feelings of paranoia crawling up my spine like a spider, they're there for a reason. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
So Jeremy Hammond did the hack, 10 years at this point. Who's the guy that's looking at 105 years at this point? It's Barrett Brown. And what's the difference? He's disseminating the information. He's doing something more dangerous than what Jeremy did.
Here's the message it sends. From the government to the hacktivists, who are getting great coverage and are becoming folk heroes through the press. Don't talk to the press, because we're going to get their computers and we're going to get their sources and we're going to get you through that. To the press who are covering the hacktivists, don't cover these hacktivists, because we're going to get you.
All right. Thank you, Scandinavia Anonymous, or vice versa. So did you see that earlier today?
Yes, I did.
I did. All right. So Thomas Drake was in there, and a very strong, forceful advocate, supporter of yours. All right. So now you're facing all of this time in prison, and you're being left without bail for 2 years. Where were you for 2 years?
I was at a couple different places. One was a Bureau of Prisons federal holding facility in Dallas, or outside of Dallas. Another was a local or county place where overflow from the feds, who you know are very compulsive about arresting people, are held because there's not enough room in the jails for the people that the prosecutors prosecute. So I was at another place called Kaufman County, which is rather horrible, and another place called Mansfield.
And what did you see mostly when you were in those holding facilities, mostly people there on minor drug offenses?
In the federal system, they're generally upper echelon drug offenders. They're generally guys who are a little bit more successful,
yeah,
who generally come out of poor environments and you know, have some business skills, and that was the best option open to them. And so they sold drugs. And
right.
Generally, we're facing 20 to 30 year sentences for being involved in what they call conspiracy to distribute, illegal substances. Pretty, very severe sentences. And you have fraud, people in for fraud, you have people in for anything involving, interstate commerce, and that's taken very broadly by the feds to determine what interstate commerce is. Anyway, so I saw a lot of, met a lot of inmates,
right,
and learned a lot about how the system works, but most importantly, I got to see how the U.S. governments and how U.S. persons will conduct themselves, if they know that they are free to do what they will. And within the prison system, partly because of the nature of what a prison is, but also in part because Congress, back in 96, passed something called the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which makes it very, very difficult for an inmate to challenge the terms of his confinement in a court. For instance, if he's being beaten or starved or held in the shoe illicitly. Partly because of that, these people who work as staff in prisons, some of whom are reasonably decent people, some of whom aren't, are generally free to violate their own laws at will, and that happens every single day.
Yes, I think that was 1996 under Clinton's omnibus,
yeah,
crime bill. Another great contribution to society by Bill Clinton. So now you're there for a couple of years waiting, and you have three charges. Now you have additional charges. Can you? What were the additional charges here?
The first thing I was actually arrested for before they got around to indicting me for the Stratford thing was threatening a federal agent. The FBI, after having raided my apartment 6 months prior to my arrest, I wasn't there. I was at my mom's house elsewhere in Dallas. And so they came there and asked for my laptops, and I said no. And they went and got a search warrant for her place. And between that time, we had hid some laptops in her kitchen cabinet. We don't want the U.S. government having access to my communications with people in Bahrain who are working in the pro-democracy campaigns there, since Bahrain is a U.S. ally, even though
right,
it's a kingdom that brings in Saudi tanks to oppress its protesters.
Local population.
Things of that nature.
Right.
So I was sort of duty-bound to do whatever I could to keep those laptops.
That was the right thing to do. Absolutely.
And so they indicted my mother, or they threatened to indict her at that point. After the raid, they said, well, your mom's going to go to prison, too, for obstruction of justice. And I chewed on that for a little while. And meantime, I learned about some other facets of this. There have been some more leaks and some more hacks of emails regarding H.P. Gary, this original company, which it turns out had been hiring people to go after me in various ways ever since this original leak happened. And I made that information available, tried to bring attention to it, said, look, I'm being, like, they've kind of green-lighted me here. These people who had put my address up and my mother's address up and pictures of my apartments and all that, some of which is information that's very hard to find. I didn't have an apartment under my own name. These people turned out to be ex-military friends of a H.P. Gary executive named Jim Butterworth. And so my situation became clearer and clearer. It became more clear that his indictments went through without this information getting out. There may not be any real attention to it, and my mother and I would both be kind of, we would be at our last end there. And so I was also getting off Suboxone, which was a synthetic opiate I took as a former heroin addict. I was getting off that so I didn't have to get off it when I was arrested, in prison. and stop taking Paxil, which is an antidepressant, which apparently if you stop taking it suddenly kind of puts you in a bit of a manic state. And so I made several videos laying out this whole history, you know, a bit rambly, but I think clear enough so that some people did indeed understand what I was talking about, and explaining that, you know, this is what the FBI is doing to me. These are crimes. There's no one I can go to. I can't go to the police. You know, we've tried the media. You know, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring attention to this by using the same tactics that Aaron Barr had conceived of using against activists, which included, as we saw in his emails, identifying family members of their targets and digging up dirt on them. So I was going to do the same thing that he had done without getting arrested to this agent, Robert Smith, who had threatened my mother, and see if they arrested me for that. And that would, you know, ostensibly provide a nice little lesson about the rule of law. Now, this wasn't a reasonable thing for me to do. It didn't work, obviously, and I was, you know, I just wasn't in a state to really evaluate whether this was appropriate or dignified on my part. But at any rate, so they arrested me the next day. Oh, I also separately said, look, I'm going to protect myself against any more armed intruders, which technically is not illegal. You can say that kind of thing. You can say, you can refer to the use of violence if it's a conditional, as in if someone is, you say, if you come and do this, I will do this.
Right.
It's not actually technically illegal. But anyway, so they conflated these statements and then threw in a statement that Bob Beckel.
Yeah, I'm going to play that. Whoa. Hey, wait. Yeah, I'm going to play that for you right now. It's only about 15 seconds long. Let me play that Bob Beckel statement here. This is about WikiLeaks.
The truth gets hurt from the American people. The way to deal with, and the national security of the United States, the way to deal with this is pretty simple. We got special ops forces. I mean, a dead man can't leak stuff. This guy's a traitor, a treasonous, and he has broken every law of the United States. The guy ought to be, and I'm not for the death penalty, so if I'm not for the death penalty, I only want to do it, illegally shoot the son of a b-.
Can you believe that? I still can't believe that. All right, go ahead. Take it from there.
So I had, after
Bob
that
Beckel.
Quote had happened, I had written that statement down in quotation marks and tweeted it out, you know, just to show here's what people are saying about Julian Assange. They're calling for his illegal assassination, quite plainly illegally, his words, you know, and put that on my Twitter, and then that ended up in my indictments, because, of course, they realized after they had arrested me that they really couldn't make the case that I had done something illegal in this case, that I hadn't quite gone under the statute of threats. So they just threw in a bunch of other weird, irrelevant things, including this. And when we challenged that in our motion to dismiss, they stuck with it. They just said, oh, well, he was promoting the idea. I mean, really extraordinary stuff. It's very, you know,
you use exactly the same language that Bob Beckel used. It's so obvious.
Well, I mean, yeah, I was quoting him. I mean, it was in quotation marks. It wasn't just, I'm going to use this same phrase and see if it affects me. I was literally quoting him in disapproval.
Right.
About this assassination he was calling for against a U.S. Australian citizen who had not been under
a publisher. It's just completely outrageous.
And he works with the New York Times and major publications and the Guardian at that time. So anyway, they threw that in. And the thing about this district, the thing about the judges down here is that you can point out all of these discrepancies, and you can point out the really bizarre aspects of the case, the fact that they were searching me for H.P. Gary and in-game systems and then never mentioned those things again and pretended it was about Stratford, which they hadn't even mentioned in my search form. You can point these things out over and over again, but it doesn't diminish their ability to come up with new assertions and have them believed by the judge and by the probation office's pre-sentencing report people. So, you know, there was a lot more to it. It's a gold mine of examples of how the federal justice system works when it doesn't work, when it's not being subject to any kind of oversight, when there's no, you know, there's no checks and balances there. This is what happens. Even when it happens in plain sight, even in this unusual case where I get a lot of media attention because the link charges were very controversial, the investigation and me to begin with was very controversial, it didn't take long after my arrest before articles started appearing summarizing what we had discovered and pointing out how important these things were and pointing out that, you know, that my investigation happened to begin right after that, well before Stratford had happened. And of course, even though Stratford linked charges, had to be dropped themselves for a number of reasons. The statute that they were citing for identity theft, that refers to the use of identifying information, government-issued IDs, not credit cards. That's aside from all of the freedom of information and journalism and First Amendment issues at stake here. And then the fact that, again, I clearly did not want to use them. Hold on one second.
What
I don't know. I'm in an interview. Sorry, I have a friend coming over. He's asking me.
It's okay. Listen, this is live on the fly. All right, we everything is off the off the cuff here. So go ahead.
So so you had all these facets kind of come together. Some of which were reported on, some of which weren't, some of which were still sealed and have yet to see the light of day. But this will all go into the book I have coming out next year. So we have a nice sort of comprehensive account of how these things work. But it was enough, even in this media environment, it was enough to get attention eventually, from New York Times, U.S. News World Report, publications abroad, that this was essentially retaliation for my journalism work.
Yes.
And, sort of a manifestation of their angst about what we were doing, mobilizing people.
Well, I'm
explaining to people, how to better assert their rights. That's something they don't like to see.
I see from this book, I'm quoting Gabriella Coleman, where she says, "You were very adept at afflicting the powerful with ironic, scathing, sardonic writings." Is that what it says? Yes. So I realize you got a lot of press back then. In fact, a lot of people went to you to learn from Anonymous how to get press. And you gave basically an online course, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I advised a lot of people on how to do it. I put a lot of, aside from all the interviews I did that were public, there was also a lot of sort of background interviews where where journalists reaching out to me. I'm trying to make sure that they have the facts that we want them to have so that the comprehensive story can be told. And then there was a lot of me sort of getting them in touch with non-participants they otherwise wouldn't be able to find, just to ensure that our side of the story and that the facts that we're bringing to bear get wide proliferation. Because it's harder than it might seem sometimes. I did this NBC Nightly News interview with, what's his name, that fellow, I can't remember anyway, back in 2011. And, they talked about the H.B. Geary.
Brian Williams.
Brian Williams was the announcer on it, but they've sent down the fellow who he's a very very beltway kind of guy. Anyway,
right.
Michael Isikoff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they had this big segment and then mentioned the H.B. Geary hack, but didn't even say a word about. And then they revealed this massive illegal conspiracy against the underpinnings of our democracy. That to them did not seem important, and that's what we're up against when we try to get out there and make sure these things are known. We're up against this very difficult media environment that's kind of marked by incompetence, and it's worse than the censorship and it's worse than the oppression. It is just the difficulty of getting the press to do their jobs, even when you're doing everything you can to help.
Well, do you think that the alternative press kind of substitutes in a good way here? Is there enough of alternative press that gets out there to the average person, or do you think it's very, very narrow, and we're just basically communicating with ourselves?
Well, we can't just rely on that. I mean, that's a facet of it, and I've seen many cases in which the alternative press did discover something and did manage, because it was so important, to get some attention from the press that has a larger viewership. But my emphasis is really on trying to make the most of this infrastructure that exists with the major outlets. And so that's why I've written for major outlets whenever I could. It's why I've always agreed to do interviews, regardless of whether or not I like the outlet itself. And I think there's a lot more to be done that kind of combines those facets, as in we have not yet begun to explore the possibilities inherent to the internet. We've experimented a little bit here and there and had some haphazard victories here and there. But we can benefit a great deal. Everyone who takes their citizenship seriously can benefit from a more fundamental rethinking of how do we take control of the information flow and ensure that facts that are not getting attention get properly analyzed and properly assessed and get a chance to be heard. And that's something that it's a process, and a number of the people I've worked with have had different experiences that are very valuable, perhaps, to creating a better framework than what we have. Not necessarily a perfect framework,
but something
that's worth doing.
Is that what Pursuant? Tell us about Pursuant. That's your new project here. But
the Pursuant system is something that it's the culmination of a lot of efforts we've made over the years. This is something I was originally planning on doing in a less ambitious form before I got involved with Anonymous. It's what Project PM was originally intended to do before before the intelligence contracting thing happened, and I had to turn it into a crowdsourced effort to research those things. it's predicated on the idea that for the first time in history, any individual can collaborate with any other individual on the planet. And all of our institutions have grown out of a very different environment, one defined by limitations on collaboration and even communication. So we've seen some successes here very haphazardly. I mean, the fact that Anonymous, in its very chaotic and accidental way, managed to go from a goofy prank group to something that the NSA had, Michael Hayden would go give a speech about how it's a danger to the country and how it'll be able to take over power plants soon. That's very telling. That shows us that things can, if they have the right factors in play from the beginning, can grow very, very quickly in this environment. And if the right people are involved at the beginning, and if they have a proper framework that allows people to come in very quickly and to get their ideas implemented and to evolve their own techniques very quickly and to share their insights on how things should be structured, what associational mechanisms work, then we're going to have something that will be able to do better journalism, better activism, and better citizen engagement.
Wow. So how do people get involved with that, by the way?
We have a site up that we put up a few weeks ago called pursuanceprojects.org. They can go there and read the main presentation of how it works, and they can sign up to receive, to be informed when it initializes, which is going to happen in a few months.
That's so pursuanceproject.org. Pursuance.
Pursuanceproject.org. P-U-R-S-U-A-N-C-project.org.
And you've got this great idea of how people can get involved here and on a
better than the idea. Than the idea. I mean, ideas can only go so far without proper implementation. In this case, thanks to my unusual circumstances, I have more ability to kind of recruit for these kind of things. And so we have a great team of people with backgrounds in cryptology and in open source development and activism building this. And we have a board of directors we're about to put into play when we get our 403C status. That's going to include Alex Winter, who did that documentary, former actor, is actually very closely tied to this information movement. Lawyers Jay Lederman and Tor Eklund, professors Robert Tynes of Bard University and Mono Singham of Case Western, retired. We have Russ Baker, who I've just gotten involved in the last few days, and a few other figures who are going to help ensure that we present this correctly, that we present this is not just for radicals.
Good.
This is for anyone who wants to come in and be in an environment in which they can actually engage in the most efficient ways possible.
I think it's a great idea. I've been reading about it. I think it's a great idea. I just read about four or five articles on it. I got to ask you this question because we only have a few minutes left. It goes by so quickly. This is from Susie Dawson from New Zealand. She just texted this to me. She says, how important and relevant is WikiLeaks to security researchers and analysts?
Well, luckily, one of WikiLeaks' purposes has been fulfilled, as they have gotten people to think about the idea of leaking and how to execute it and how to present materials when you receive them. And so you now have groups like The Intercept, you know, who have sort of set up to, you know, receive leaked information. There was obviously a debacle happened a few weeks ago with this Reality Winner thing. It's kind of very strange, but it looks like she may have done a lot of things that allowed her to be identified by the government pretty quickly. There's no 100%, you know, secure method of leaking. There never will be, because a lot of the detection happens on that end. You have companies like Raytheon, we've seen developing techniques to try to detect leakers before they leak based on changes in behavior.
How do you adjust to that?
You know, I think it's a complicated question. I don't think there's a short answer I can really give.
All right. We'll have you back on. You can give us that answer. So I just have a few minutes left here. I can't believe it. You have been hassled since you were released in November. First, you disappeared for 4 days, and then you did one television show, and you got all sorts of heat for that. And the next thing you know, they're asking The Intercept for their records. This is, I think, Heath. Is that the name of the prosecutor in Dallas?
Heath was the previous prosecutor, and she would seem to be involved, but it's actually being done under another assistant U.S. Attorney General in this district named Mills. I can't remember.
It doesn't matter. They're all the same. They all look alike.
Yes. They're trying to obtain not just my financial records with The Intercept, which they claim in this subpoena to be in relation to the restitution I've been ordered to pay. Supposedly they're just checking up to make sure I'm not hiding money from them. But of course they actually have my bank account number. I put up a letter yesterday, which you may have seen, explaining all these things and mailed it to them, pointing out that again, I worked for The Intercept well before this 10% restitution thing where I have to pay 10% of all my income to pay off this massive restitution that the judge ordered.
$900,000?
Yep,
$900,000. Yep. We got to get you back on just to talk about Stratford for 30 minutes and another 30 minutes on Jeremy Hammond.
They're definitely worth talking about.
Yes, and, I know, and Jeremy Hammond as well, who is rotting in jail. Have you remained in contact with Jeremy Hammond at all?
Informally, not directly. When you're in prison, when you're in the BOP custody whatsoever, even home confinement, you're technically
indirectly
not allowed to talk to other inmates. Yep.
Yeah, indirectly.
So indirectly, yes.
Yes. All right, well, he's a great guy, and I was there on the day of his sentencing, and it was a very sad day, doing 10 years in prison. One last thing. I see that you've read 500 books. You were sent 1,000 books while in prison, and you read 500, and your favorite was one on Emma Goldman, who's one of my heroes.
Yeah, it was.
In 1 minute, tell me why you like Emma Goldman.
Emma Goldman was someone who took responsibility for a country that she hadn't even been born in. As soon as she got over here, she engaged in a massive decades-long campaign to win rights, reproductive rights for women, free speech rights. She was an anarchist, reproductive rights for women, free speech rights. She was an anarchist of this Jewish-Russian anarchist tradition. She was close to Alexander Berkman, who was a early hero of mine. And she was someone who went to jail a number of times.
And then deported.
And for writing.
Yes, and then deported.
She's someone who's been deported, absolutely. And then when she got to Soviet Russia and saw that that was not going according to plan, she immediately attacked them. She was someone who did not join with something because it might lead to something.
Barrett Brown, continue your mission out there. You've got a great record. You got a lot of work to do ahead of you, and you're a young man. And continue the great work. And thank you for your service for making this a better country. Thank you. Barrett Brown. All right. We're out of here. I'm sorry. I went overtime. I'm Randy Credico. This is Live on the Fly. I'm here with Tony Ryan. And if we have any time for Louie, I guess not. Goodbye. It's my birthday.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin.